Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This week we talk with Orit Avishai about women's participation in conservative and fundamentalist religion, and how sometimes we may lose sight of what's really happening when we focus only on the veil. Dr. Avishai is in the Sociology and Anthropology Department at Fordham University and is the author of the fall 2010 Contexts magazine article, Women of God. This week we talk with Orit Avishai about her recent piece in Contexts. And Orit, I thought we would just start by talking about the piece, which is called Women of God. In many ways, this is a response to the popular notion that God is bad for women. So can you provide us this where you think this notion comes from? And what does it miss when we simplify it to that?
So I think there are two sources that are theoretically or conceptually related to one another. One of them is the women's movement and feminist perceptions of religion as one of those institutions that are responsible for continuing institutions of inequality, gender inequality between men and women. And quite justifiably so, in many cases, in many religions, women are considered to be inferior to men. Women are not allowed to be ordained in many religious traditions. There are a variety of practices surrounding women's bodies, etc. So that's one legacy of the women's movement throughout the 20th century, but really intensifying in the 1970s, 1980s. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is a more sort of general political philosophy of enlightenment and the connections that we make between modernization, secularization, westernization. And the assumption is that in order to be free, you need to be free from all constraints, including those represented by religion. Go ahead.
Well, that kind of does set us up with this paradox that you present in the piece then. So why do women actively participate in religion if there are sort of some structural barriers in place there for them? What's your take on that sort of incongruence that some people might see?
So, you know what, I'll step back a bit and then I'll tell you where I come in. Up to the 1970s, 1980s, really the notion was that there was no good explanation for women's participation in religion other than either they were kind of dupes.
Oh, wow.
They were just following tradition, not unthinking, false consciousness kinds of explanations. And then as people started looking more carefully into women's actual experiences with conservative religions, we started to see more nuanced understandings. Well, women participate in conservative religions because it's practical in some way, or because it serves some other purposes external to religion. The difficulty with those kinds of explanations are that they inherently assume a paradox, right? They inherently assume that religion, as we say in the piece, bad for women, that there is something inherent about it that is incongruent with a modern, liberal, free subject. Mm-hmm. That is that paradox approach. And then when you look empirically, many women are involved in religions, in conservative religions.
Right.
Either they're born to these religions and they choose to stay, or they choose for a variety of reasons to join. Go ahead.
Your role as the researcher then is kind of complicated because you're asking people about very personal decisions, but these decisions also have sort of this political or cultural stereotype stuff that you have to work through. I mean, how do you go about researching this then while balancing those two sides of it?
Well, okay, so I'll give you that personal story, how I got to researching these topics. I don't really talk about my own research in this piece.
Right.
But it is based on very extensive research that I did among Orthodox Jews in Israel, and in particular, looking at practices surrounding menstrual impurity, which are virtually unknown outside Orthodox Judaism, but are very, very central to Orthodox Jewish identity, Orthodox Jewish life. And what these practices boil down to are a set of practices that regulate women's behavior, a couple's economy of sexual access and physical intimacy that are determined by women's menstrual status. So if they're menstruating or if they're within a week of menstruation and they haven't gone through a very complicated process of purification, they are inaccessible to each other.
Wow.
So that's kind of by way of just setting up the stage. And in my dissertation, which I pursued in Berkeley, you know, a very progressive institution, very, very similar on the one hand, and also, but also very interested in cultural diversity on the other.
Uh-huh.
I thought, well, if I take everything that I'm learning here about cultural diversity, about respecting this cultural diversity and not imposing my own Berkeley-ish perspective.
Yeah.
What does that mean to go back to Israel where I grew up and looking at the Orthodox community? Because I should also add that these menstrual practices for non-Orthodox women, for secular women of my generation in Israel, these menstrual practices symbolized everything that was wrong and backwards about Orthodox Judaism. So when I stepped back into that cultural terrain, yes, as you put it beautifully, I had to negotiate a lot of my own impressions, researcher, to really step back and objectively say, okay, are there other ways of understanding why women adhere to these particular practices, and are there other meanings of these practices?
Right.
Very easy to say, well, you know, these kinds of practices objectify women, they subject them to a whole patriarchal understanding of the female body, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I mean, did you, when you started, you know, the transition from, you know, I live here, I grew up here, to this is my site, I'm a field researcher now, did you have either some problems connecting with people in that role, or any personal moments that were kind of difficult for you? I mean, I imagine that's got to be an interesting transition.
Right. Well, there are several layers there, right? I mean, when you go as a researcher into the field, you always have to establish your legitimacy. So on the one hand, it was easy because I started out, I ended up with almost 100 interviews, but they all started with acquaintances and friends, and I snowballed from there.
Right.
But I interviewed some very, very prominent women in the Orthodox community, and especially with them, and then the further away I got, you know, from my initial contact, I had to establish legitimacy, and they would ask, well, you know, why are you interested in this? You know, are you going to ridicule us? And I came up with this line that ended up being very theoretically rich for me, saying, you know, if I wanted to criticize these practices, I don't need to interview anybody. I could just write. I've read enough feminist theory, right, to write a scathing critique of these practices. But, and this was truly genuine, you know, I said, what I really want to do is to understand the multiple meanings, the richness of the experience. And one of the things I learned, and this was very humbling, And this is one of the insights that goes into my thinking about a lot of the literature in this area as sort of coming from a paradox approach, that to really comprehend such practices, we cannot come in, we as researchers, with our set of assumptions about what it means to be a modern subject, right? We can't all assume that to be a modern subject, you have to be free of some higher powers, and that we should all strive to a particular notion of either equality or subjecthood, because ultimately the women that I was interviewing had a very different understanding of even concepts such as menstrual impurity, which, again, to secular women of my generation, you know, that's just like a red flag. Yeah. To them, it meant something else. It meant something about relationship with God. It meant something about following one's tradition.
Right. Did you find that this conceptual framework was very specific to that site, or is this something that you've brought into other areas of inquiry?
Well, I actually am bringing this to other areas of inquiry, and I actually have some work that I'm doing with colleagues who worked in other equally paradoxical sites, if you like, right? Sites that are what we think of as conservative, what we think of, and the we here stand for progressive sociologists.
Right, okay.
I mean there is an assumption of who we are, right?
Definitely.
What we think of as conservative social spaces that promote or that are organized around understanding of human relationships, understanding of society, understanding of what kinds of the vision of the good world, or, you know, the good life.
Yeah.
And what we sort of collectively have come to think of is that the role of the objective researcher really is to step back and be able to critically analyze some of these very assumptions that we bring with us to the field. And I find it very unsatisfying, right? Because it's very easy to say, well, some of these practices or some of these conservative social spaces have an oppressive moment, right? If we take the veil as an example, women donning the veil, you know, there is just your paradigmatic example of the oppressed woman. Oh, but on the other hand, it's also a symbol of women's empowerment because these women choose to wear the veil.
Right.
Okay. So there's a duality, but it doesn't get at the core, or it not doesn't sufficiently get at the core of the meanings of these practices to some of the research subjects.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I'd like to just learn a bit more about that. I mean, let's assume that some of our listeners aren't as knowledgeable about the debate. Can you give us some of the background and why this has risen? I mean, it's a global conversation now on how to talk about and act upon veil policy. So can you just fill us in on that a bit?
Right. So the veil has become, right, the symbol of the oppressed woman, but not just any oppressed woman, but the oppressed Muslim woman, right? And there are several layers there. There's that layer of how we perceive of free women, right? The free subject, right? As one who is free to choose her profession, free to choose her direction in life, free to choose her life partner, and free to choose her clothes. So that's one direction. The other, of course, has to do with the demonizing of Muslims and anything that's associated with Islam in the current global political arena. So I think those two come together. And if you look at some of the rhetoric that led up to U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, some of it was about the plight of Afghan women, right? We're going to go and liberate Afghan women. Now, the point is not that Afghan women or other women who are veiled, the point is not that they are not possibly oppressed by their religion, their culture, their tradition. They might be. Mm-hmm. The point is that there are other ways to understand why women veil. And there are other ways to think about veiling as a cultural practice, veiling, and some of these ways are, you know, women sometimes don the veil because this allows them a flexibility in certain traditional societies that they otherwise wouldn't have, because it sort of extends the notion of the home and the protection that the home provides when they step outside into the public sphere. That is very difficult for us in the West to understand. But there are multiple findings from many countries that point to the fact that veiling actually allows women a lot more freedom than they otherwise would have had. In some contexts, such as Turkey, women moved to veiling in the 1990s. Was led by highly educated women on college campuses, and they donned the veil as part of a nationalist statement, as part of a response to Westernization and a sense that Turkey was being dominated by foreign powers and foreign ideas. Mm-hmm. So other ways of understanding the veil. Then the third layer comes with the work of anthropologist Saba Mahmoud, who argues, and this is very much in line of what I found in Israel, that practices such as veiling are not only about either oppression or empowerment, but they speak to the core of what it means to be a religious subject. And by practicing veiling, a woman effectively becomes, okay, so there's this process of becoming a pious religious subject. So it's a training of sorts, and she likens it to dancers and musicians who spend hours on end practicing, refining their skills. And that is a very different perspective on veiling, or, you know, other kinds of religious practices, that there are sites where people become, right? People become religious subjects through the very act of subjection or to religious demand.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's very, very fascinating. It's, why do you think the veil has become the icon? Do you think it's just because it's ubiquitous or because it's physically visible? Or, I mean, is it just easier for people to talk about? Why do you think it's become the center of, like, these very deeper and larger debates?
I you know, all of the above. I think part of it has to do, it's a very tangible icon, right? Mm-hmm. Know, free women. Oh, you know, women who don the veil, or women, or other kinds of covering cannot be free, right? Because the free subject should be seen, right? Should be visibly accessible. Mm-hmm. What of course is missing in this debate is a more sophisticated understanding of what it really means to be free of external constraints. Mm-hmm. Write about this in this piece, and I've talked to other professors who teach sociology, and this always comes up in conversations in classes about either oppression or cultural values. It's always that iconic covered woman who is not free, or who doesn't, who's subject to constraints.
Do you see the work of researchers such as yourself helping to maybe eventually change this, the one-sided sort of public view, or Western public view on the veil, or do you think it'll be a bit more nuanced and contextualized over time, or is it one of those things that people probably just won't budge on? I know, it's a tough question, because I know what we'd like the answer to be, but...
I mean, sadly, I'm becoming increasingly cynical. So my intellectual question is yes, right? I mean, this is why we do research, right? This is why, I mean, we go out, or part of the reason that we do research, we go out, we inquire about the world around us, and we uncover other ways of looking at the world, right? I mean, this is sociology 101. This is sociological imagination.
Right.
Putting things in context and making the familiar strange. On the other hand, you know, cynical me says in the current political and cultural environment where people consume only the kinds of opinions they want to consume, you need to be open, right? You need to be open to hearing about other opinions and perspectives that are very different from your own. So,
yeah, no, I know where you're coming from. And you know, as we get near the end of the interview, I was thinking about your article, and a lot of the times, you know, we do these things called discoveries in the front end of the Context magazine, and it's very easy for us sometimes to always set up these discoveries where we write little synopses of new research that blank is bad for women, blank is bad for women, you know, and then in this point, it's kind of like, is God, you know, in your piece, is God bad for women? And so two questions is, you know, from what you've learned and what you've written, is God bad for women? And maybe on the flip side of all of these debates, you know, what is good for women then? What's the silver lining?
Is God bad for women? You know, it depends. God can be bad for women. God can be good for women. The sociological perspective on God, of course, is that God in and of itself, right? Religion in and of itself is a construct. So it depends how religion is used or abused. Mm-hmm. It depends on who controls the message, who controls the institution. Mm-hmm. But to understand the nuances, we can't just come in, and this takes us back to what we talked about in the beginning, we can't come in with our own Western American assumptions about the good life, right? We have to listen to people and how they live their lives. Mm-hmm. To surmise whether God and religion are bad for women. What is good for women? Again, I come to a roundabout way. A few years ago, I had a student in an intro to women's studies course who at the end of the class said, you know, this is not intro to women's studies. This is intro to life studies.
Yeah.
No, and the message there, and I think that, again, we've come a long way since the women's studies of the 1970s,
right,
is that, you know, we need to inquire what is good for humankind in general, what is good for societies, what is good for communities. And one of the most important messages that come out of research such as my own is that we cannot impose one universal standard, right? That just will not work. Are there limits to this relativism? Yes, of course. What are they? I do not know. I do know that, you know, veiling and practices such as menstrual purity and other things are probably on the good side of that line of relativism. So that's not really answering your question.
Yeah. No, but it's
But it's the contours and really, and I think that this is part of our role as researchers, as teachers in the classroom, to remind people that one's own set of assumptions and perception of the good life are not shared and cannot be shared.
So what is sometimes conceived as bad may be good. And there's just very, there are very simple value judgments to put on very complex.
Right. Because it's easy. You know, it's just easy.
Well, this has been really interesting. I have like a million more questions I want to ask you about your research, but maybe we'll attempt a follow-up off the air about that. Thank you so much for being part of our podcast today.
Thank you so much. And the opportunity to talk about it.
That's great. For our listeners, you can find Orit's piece on the context.org website. And of course, some links we'll be posting on societypages.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, I'll stop the recorder.
Okay, thank you.
And that's all for Office Hours this week. Sorry for the poor audio quality in this episode. Sometimes this newfangled technology just fails us, you know? Happy New Year. See y'all soon. Can you hear me?